Was of Basque independence during the last 2 years, leading to intensified pressure from French and Spanish police. Some 820 people have died in ETA attacks over the last 40 years. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning in Paris.
U.S. Navy officials said today that pirates have hijacked a Saudi oil tanker off the coast of Kenya and are towing it to a port in Somalia. The supertanker was seized Saturday. It can hold as much as 2 million barrels of crude oil. This is the first oil tanker taken by pirates. The shipping routes off East Africa are among the most dangerous in the world. Many of the pirates come from Somalia, which hasn't had a functioning government since 1991. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chevy, developing the Chevy Volt, a car that will go up to 40 miles on a fully charged battery before using any gas.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're pleased to have once again here on the program with us Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's been here many times, and the purpose is to give you the opportunity to call in and ask questions about problems around the house. If something is not working right, if you're thinking about making some changes, it may well be that I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about energy efficiency, things they can do to make their home tighter so it's warmer in the winter and so the heating bill is not quite so much. Any questions that have to do with things like windows and siding, basements, gutters, roofs, attics, doors, windows. Did I say that one already? Anyway, any of the various parts of a single-family home, you got questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. We'll pay for the call. 800-222-9455. So at any point here, we'll take just as many calls as we can, and you got questions, you give us a call, and we'll get you right in. Well, thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, David. Thank you for inviting me.
We already have somebody ready to go. Let's talk with them on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Perhaps you can tell me, when is the least damaging weather for climbing on the asphalt roof when it's hot and sticky or when it's cold and brittle?
Well, obviously, either one is not ideal. Generally speaking, the spring and fall is the best time to get up on there when things are at a fairly nominal temperature. Now, cold and brittle, in below freezing weather, the shingles do get quite stiff and you can actually break the shingles. And in hot weather, they're soft enough that you can actually start wearing the granules off. So the two of them we'd try and avoid. I would say winter would be better because if it's really cold out, you're probably going to slide down off the shingles anyway, so it's not going to damage the shingles too much.
But, It might damage you. Okay.
But yeah, spring and fall is usually the best time to get on the shingles. Sometime you really don't want to start getting on the shingles once it gets up much over about 100 to 110 degrees, and the shingles get that hot very easily with a little bit of sunlight. And likewise, you want to try and stay off of them, like I say, once it starts dropping down below the freezing level.
I guess that same advice goes for replacing the roof. You don't want to get a roof when it's cold out.
Well, there are specific cold weather shingles which have a little bit different chemical makeup on the tar strip or the glue strip that helps hold the tabs down. The problem with installing shingles in really cold weather or even when we start getting down into the 50s and 40s is that the tar strip that's on the shingle that holds the tab down doesn't pick up enough heat to actually hold the tab down. And then we get some good winter weather coming through, and we tend to lift or blow the tabs upward, creating a crease right at the tab mark. And there's a lot of times when I've inspected houses that have had multiple tabs torn off, or of houses that were put – the roofing was done in extreme cold where the shingles just never got around to sealing. If you put them on when they're cold and that tar strip is fairly solidified, you can get a little bit of dust and dirt on the tar strip. And so even when it heats up next time, it doesn't have the adhesion that it's supposed to help hold those tabs down.
What do we do for loose tabs?
Usually if you've got a lot of loose tabs, the best thing is to get a little bit of roofing tar or blackjack and lift the tabs up and put a dab or two of roofing cement underneath them and kind of glue them back down.
Maybe a brick on top?
As a temporary fixture, yes. But like I say, usually you can get some roofing tar and keep it in the house where it's nice and warm. Go up there in your caulking gun and put it underneath the tab, and it'll glue down pretty quick.
Roof shingles, asphalt, are 10 years old, starting to show wear, of course, in the valleys. What can I do to repair or reinforce them?
Well, the valleys always will get the most wear because that's where most of the water comes down. Depending on what type of valley you've got, an open valley where we have a mineral roll roofing in the center of the valley, you can spread a layer of roofing tar or fibered roofing cement in the valley to help extend its life.
The black or the aluminum?
Well, it really doesn't make much difference. Both of them have qualities which will help prevent wear. The aluminum is a little bit more sunlight resistant, so it's a little bit longer life than what the black is. And a lot of times people like the looks of the aluminum better. If you've got a whiter or lighter grade shingle, they don't like to have the big black streak going down through the middle of it.
Yeah.
It's very common for the valleys to wear about 5 years, and let's give or take 4 to 6 years prior to the rest of the shingles wearing out, just because of the additional wear from the water running down through the valleys.
And just put the aluminum tar right down them.
Yep, just spread a real thin layer on it. Be careful not to step in the valley. The valley material actually should have at least two, if not three, layers there. Usually there's a metal flashing underneath there and then two layers of the mineral roll roofing. Sometimes I've seen roofs that are installed without the metal flashing in the bottom of it, so you've just got the two mineral roll roofing layers. And if you step in that layer, you can actually get a crack all the way through it, and then you definitely have a leak.
So if one breaks through, chances are there's another one under it.
There should be, yes.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. We'll go to another caller here, somebody on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I live in what was originally a single-family house built about 60 years ago, and at some point the basement was built out into a second apartment. And when that happened, there was another furnace added into the furnace room that was the original furnace room in the basement, along with, I guess, a separate circuit box, and it now also houses a washer and dryer for the downstairs apartment. So there's the original furnace room. It has two furnaces, so they're separate systems. However, that still leaves my air source in someone else's apartment. I have no access to it except through their apartment, and I have no access to my circuit box except through their apartment. And since they moved in, there's been air quality issues in terms of causing, you know, burning eyes and burning in the throat. I have asthma and allergies. And this is continuing, and it's gotten worse. And this was a problem even before I had any of my forced air on. So it seemed like it was coming through the ducts, but without necessarily forced air. And fragrances come through the ducts, so I know that there's some leakage, even though they're technically separate systems. So my question is there anything that could be wrong with the furnaces that could somehow, you know, be causing fumes to come into my apartment? Because the problem seems really, it's worse when someone's home. And so I don't know if that means something, the air is stirred up. I'm fairly certain it's not cigarette smoke because I don't smell smoke. It acts like smoke in terms of how it provokes allergies and asthma to a great degree, but it's a no-smoking apartment, both of them, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And I don't smell smoke, and they're nice people. I mean, I've directly asked them, and they say they're not smoking. But is there something else that could be that provocative of, you know, making eyes burn and sinuses burn, and it's been causing dizziness, headaches? I know that's a lot of information, but needed to have the situation.
Well, I would assume that you do have your carbon monoxide and smoke detectors set up, as that is a law here in the state of Illinois.
Yes, there is.
And so that's checking for the carbon monoxide and also for any additional smoke, although most cigarette smoke won't trip one. The furnace system itself is actually a sealed system. You've got your return air duct that goes back to the furnace. It goes through the heat exchanger and gets the air that's then distributed through the plenum and ductwork. So it is a sealed system. It is only supposed to be pulling air from one unit. You're not supposed to be able to mix air from one unit to another. In other words, you are not supposed to have a return air either in the basement within 5 feet of the furnace. If it's not part of your unit, then it shouldn't be from there at all.
Okay, well, and that's the problem is that, A, they're closer together than 5 feet. I mean, the furnaces are literally next to each other, and they are both in the downstairs apartment.
Okay, that's not the same thing. The furnaces can be almost touching. They have to be, I believe, 2 inches apart by the manufacturers. But the return air duct itself is the one that comes into your unit to draw the air. When the fan kicks on, it draws air from your unit and blows it back into your unit.
Okay, so it circulates only then in that system? I mean, I'm not getting air from their apartment?
If the furnace system is installed correctly, you are not getting any air from the furnace from their apartment. In other words, they should be on a separate return system and a separate supply system than what you are.
Okay, but what about air from their apartment in general? Because it is located in their apartment, so any air that is taken in?
I doubt that there is any air barrier or weather barrier between the two units, particularly since it was originally built as a single-family house. We don't have a sheet of plastic or anything between it. So can we get air through the two units? Yes. Is it going to be through the furnace system? Not if the furnace system is installed properly.
Okay. And then can I ask also about, is it possible that ductwork could be, you know, I know the ducts have not been cleaned in at least 10 years. And probably longer than that. And is it possible that the ducts could be so dirty that they're causing some kind of problem? I mean, is there that much buildup or?
Actually, there's usually very little buildup in the ductwork. I know when we had our website up at one point in time, we had some links to some government sites that had studies done on duct cleaning, and they debunked it and said that duct cleaning really doesn't do much. I realize that we do have some cases where duct cleaning is effective, but I don't think it's quite as widely spread as what, of course, the duct cleaning companies want us to believe.
Yeah.
If the filter is in place, you should be taking your return air back to the furnace, going through a filter and filtering out most of the particles, depending on what type of filter you've got as to how efficient it is, and then blowing back through the ducts. When you get dirt in the ducts, there's very little change that actually starts moving it. In other words, once it's there, very rarely are you banging on the ducts, breaking the dust loose. So usually once it's there, it's there. It doesn't really go through anything. Depending on how old the ductwork is, it can be a plastic ductwork, it can be a metal ductwork, or it could be some of the old fiberglass ductwork. And the old fiberglass ductwork, of course, is a little coarser on the inside, so it will hold more dust and dirt, but it also will trap that because it doesn't move as easily.
Yeah. Is there anything else that could be, you know, stirred up when people are home down there? Again, in the absence of cigarette smoke, I don't know. You know, is it possible that carpeting could be deteriorating, and if they move around and it still somehow gets, I mean, if I could make my nose start to run at will within, you know, 30 seconds when it wasn't before, or my eyes get bloodshot and I might think I was losing my mind. But, I mean, this happens. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there, I'm just fine, and all of a sudden my nose will run, my throat gets tight, I have asthmatic reactions, and it doesn't seem to matter what I do in my house. I mean, I do everything I need to do, and this problem wasn't happening before they moved in. So I'm just honestly, you know, confounded as to what the trigger here is.
Well, over the radio, of course, it's impossible to go through there and check it. But
right.
Probably your best bet at this point in time would be to get an air quality test, where they come in there and they actually do some sniffs or samples of air, and then analyze them to see what kind of dust, allergens, dander, things like that, they're in the house. Because while apparently you do have some acute allergies, the only way to really track them down and find out exactly what type of pollens or what kind of materials are in the air is to do some air sampling tests.
Yeah, well, and I do know, I mean, I know about many of my allergies and do avoid those triggers, but since this was so coincident with their coming to live here, I just wondered if something could be stirred up or moved around or whatever. But
I guess the answer to that would be anything could be stirred up or moved around.
Right. That's true. And as far as the air sampling, do you know where would you find out about who could do that or that kind of test?
I do know of a company here in town. If you'd be interested in calling over to our office at some point in time, I'd be more than happy to give that number out.
Okay. All right. And so you're just in the phone book?
Yes.
Under Spies?
Yes, Spies Home Inspection Service.
Okay. Well, thank you for
all
your
right,
time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're here talking this morning with Scott Spies. He's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and once a month on a Monday, he's here, and we talk about home maintenance issues. If you have a question, I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, good. I have a question. You were talking to a person about leaking valleys, and I had one of those, and it's fixed now, but there was dampness that got into the house in the ceiling, and it's a popcorn ceiling, and now that it's dry, it still has that little black, little, you know, mildewy look to it. So I'm thinking maybe this would be the time to get rid of those popcorn ceilings that I really don't like very much. Is there a way to do that, to replace the ceiling, or do we have to rip out massive quantities of ceiling and put new boards and stuff in?
Well, depending on how well it's attached, anytime you've got the popcorn or the spray-on ceiling, it's a little tricky to get off. It's one of those things where it stays in place unless you don't want it to. Or unless you want it to, then it comes loose. If you paint it and get it too wet, it likes to peel down. If it gets moist from leaks, it wants to come down. But when you want to take it off, the stuff is up there like super glue. it's really difficult to play with. Depending on what type of material was used, most of the time it's a paper fiber or something that they use in there, or even I've seen some styrofoam-type additives that they put in there to give it that little – texture.
It was built back in the 60s, I believe, vintage house.
Your best bet is to check with a couple of painters in town and see what they can do. Usually they can get it wet. I've seen them go to the extreme of even squirting it with spray bottles and then using a putty knife and lightly scraping it off, something to dampen it. Usually when it's dampened, it'll come off in a layer. But
and then you just, you know, like you have the floor covered and then you just let it fall. And
right. Yes. You put everything in a layer of plastic and then you basically dampen it and scrape it off. And then they'll have to go back over there with a sanding board and do a finished sand before they can prime and paint it again.
Okay. So then you're really left with if the boards aren't warped or anything from any of the dampness that came from the leaking roof.
They may have to do some spot repair, because a lot of times they'll put the textured ceiling up to cover over the fact that they didn't do a A1 job of doing the spackling or the mud work on all the joints and seams and such. So you may have a little bit of drywall work to do to smooth things out. Of course, you'll want to put a flat paint on it, not a gloss paint, because a gloss paint or even a semi-gloss paint will show
shiny dark blue.
Yeah, it will show absolutely every imperfection in the drywall and every nail and every seam.
Okay. Well, that gives me an idea of the massive quantity of work we have.
Yeah, it's one of those labor-intensive, messy jobs, but not. It's usually not entirely impossible to do. The worst-case scenario, of course, if it doesn't want to come off or if they didn't prime the board behind it well, so you end up damaging the drywall, then you end up putting another thin layer of drywall over the top of what's there.
Oh, so you can put like a thinner...
You'd take like a 3/8 drywall and screw it with a little bit longer drywall screw, and so you end up screwing all the way through the original drywall into the joists that hold it up.
And everything would be brand new. Okay. Well, thank you for your advice.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to line number 3, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is Maurice.
Hi.
I had a question about my bathroom. We were about to replace the floor. There's a vinyl over a piece of plywood, and we're starting to pull up the vinyl and the plywood at a corner near the tub. It looks like the subfloor has water damage, like it doesn't have good structural integrity. But as we were digging around more, it just appears to be, I don't know, maybe like a 6 by 6 inch square area that has the damage, and the rest seems to be, it just seems to be one of the boards that's going underneath the edge of the tub is bad, and the rest of them are fine. And I guess I'm wondering whether we need to redo the whole subfloor, or whether that little bit of damage is not enough to prevent us from, you know, putting new tiling down.
Well, it's very, very common to have some water damage, particularly at tub corners where water can get it down around shower curtains and such. And the corners do get soft. Is this a second floor or a first floor? Or?
It would be – you mean a second level
bathroom?
Floor?
Yeah.
It's a good question. This is an old house. It's 70 years. So.
Is the bathroom upstairs or main floor?
It's the main floor.
It's the main floor, and, so there's a basement under it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Unfinished, so.
Then you should be able to go down there and actually look to see to the extent of the damage under the tub. If you can't see much of any damage from underneath the tub, then most likely you're just in the subflooring, not into the – or into the underlayment, not necessarily into the subflooring.
I have gone underneath, and I have inspected that bad piece of subfloor, and – it only appears to be that, like I said, maybe a 6-inch area of that one.
From a structural integrity point, I don't see that you've got any issue. What I would recommend is that you cut out the poor quality wood or anything that's damaged, chisel it out or cut it out with a sawzall or whatever you can do. And I've seen on most of the repairs would involve cutting a similar size piece of wood, putting it up there, and then you can put just a piece of, say, 1/2 inch or 3/4 inch plywood under from the bottom side to a larger piece that we could screw to the good wood and kind of give it some support. Now, anytime you put down a vinyl flooring, it really should have an underlayment over the top of the subflooring, because vinyl flooring will...
Oh, I see. That's what you mean. Yeah, that there is a piece of plywood underlayment going...
Yeah, and you may need to replace that the underlayment. Vinyl flooring is very good at what we call telegraphing. Basically, any imperfections underneath it will tend to show through it because it does have a shiny surface to it. And so your underlayment is designed to take up the imperfections. Usually it's a very thin, like 5/16 or thinner Luon board, which has a very fine texture. And then you use a floor compound to actually smooth off the nails and the seams and such, so when you put your vinyl, it doesn't telegraph through. So if you do a little bit of support from underneath, you know, replace the bad wood, support it from underneath, and then put a new piece of underlayment underneath there, you should be fine.
Okay. Do I I need to do the underlayment for the entire bathroom or just the area that I'm cutting out?
If the underlayment and the rest of the bathroom is in good shape, then you just put in a new piece and then you use a little bit of a floor stone or some other smoothing compound to blend the joint.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. And we'll continue here. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month, solves on a Monday, to answer questions about home maintenance. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We're about midway through here. And we'll talk next with someone in Danville, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi. Question about a furnace. You were just talking about the duct cleaning. My wife called me a little while ago. Said there was smoke coming out of the furnace. Ducts, evidently, in the two back rooms. Is it possible for a child to put something down the ducts, which would cause that, or is that just something maybe lodged in the firebox?
Well, smoke is never a good thing.
Exactly.
Occasionally we'll get an odor, and I have seen just a little bit of color when a furnace is first fired up, particularly if the furnace filter has not been used or changed or even installed. If you get some dust and dirt on the heat exchanger will get hot enough to where you could end up with a little bit of a burn-off. But usually that only happens in the first firing of the furnace. So if it's been on more than once or twice this year, then and you've got smoke coming out of it now, I would suggest we do some very fast investigation to find out what it is. I doubt very much that anything that would be dropped down by a small child, all the return air side should be blocked by a filter, so none of that material should ever get to the heat exchanger.
Right. The filter's in place. Everything's in place. And when I went home to check it out, I didn't see anything, but I don't know. There was a bit of an odor.
I won't say it's impossible that something could get on the heat exchanger. I've seen interesting things. It's not necessarily pleasant to think about, but if a small mouse or something got into one of the registers and went down there and ended up on that heat exchanger, it does get hot enough that it could produce an odor. There's other things that could get in there as well, dust, dirt, etc.
Maybe somebody cleaning and inspecting it just to make sure everything's fine with it then.
If you've had smoke coming out of it, particularly if it happens more than once and it's not the first time you fired the furnace up, I would very highly recommend getting somebody over there pretty quick.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And let's go on here. Next up, we'll talk with somebody in Muhammad. Line number 1. Hello.
Yes. I was just going to say this woman who called and said that she had dizziness and burning and all that sort of thing. And she said she had a carbon monoxide in her house, but this sounds like a gas leak. I mean, I would, if I were her, I would call the power company and have them come and check, because this sounds like a gas leak, flat out. I've had them before, and, you know, they'll come out and check it for nothing. And if I were her, I would do that. Now, she said she had a carbon monoxide detector, but, I doubt that. This sounds like a gas leak, and that's all I wanted to see is say is a help to her.
All right.
Well, very
Thank
good.
You.
Wouldn't hurt.
The only thing I would add to that is that it did seem to be directly linked to the people going in and out next door, which would probably not be a gas issue, although it could stir things up, I suppose. Usually natural gas has an odor to it, a percaptan is put into it. So it's not an odorless. The carbon monoxide is odorless by Illinois state law. As of January of 07, everybody has to have a smoke detector and carbon monoxide detector in their properties. So hopefully that is up and running. I will admit the carbon monoxide detectors don't always detect as far down as what I think they should go. Most of the general store-bought units start sounding an alarm at about 35 parts per million. Whereas you can actually get a water heater with the flue knocked off of it only burning at about 12 or 14 parts per million. So you could actually be putting in the carbon monoxide or all the flue gases from a water heater or something like that into the house and never trip off a carbon monoxide detector. Of course, a gas flame is only really producing high or what we consider lethal doses of carbon monoxide if it's not burning properly. A yellow flame will put off high levels of carbon monoxide, whereas a blue flame is burning quote-unquote clean and not producing the carbon monoxide. But carbon monoxide is also something that can be built up in the bloodstream. So low levels, long-term exposure can be as much of a problem as high levels and short-term exposure.
Yeah, okay. Well, I appreciate the call. I mean, what maybe people should understand, as you say, is that natural gas, the thing that we use in our ranges and our furnaces, by itself doesn't have any smell at all. They put that smell in there because they want to make sure that if there is a leak, you notice it. And then obviously, if you do smell that, then you really do need to call your utility company and have somebody check it out, because it's not something that you want to be happening.
Yeah, don't use a match to go try and find it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate the call. Let's go to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Our house has a great big masonry wood-burning fireplace that naturally some schmuck in the past put a gas log in, which produces about as much heat as a 40-watt light bulb. I mean, you know, into the room. It sends heat up the chimney really well, but it doesn't put anything in the room. And one of the things I've been thinking about doing, and my initial study on the web, I get mixed to views here. I was putting in an airtight enclosure, taking the gas log out, putting an airtight enclosure in, and to supplement the heating of the house, burning paper logs. What do you know about burning paper logs, supplemental heat? Is it a bad practice, an indifferent practice, so on and so forth? And what do you know, if anything, about there are gas inserts also that actually will produce some heat. Unfortunately, one of the dealers around here wants to palm off a unvented gas heater, and I know damn good and well not to do that. So speak on that subject, if you would, please. Thank you.
Well, I have to admit I am not an expert on auxiliary heating systems. It's not something I run into on a real regular basis. I know that, yes, it is in some cases you can get some more additional heat by putting in one of the paper logs or even a wood burning, but you are also having to increase your maintenance on it. So when you stop and think of fuel prices, you have to take into account the amount of extra time that you have put in it, and if your time has any value to it whatsoever, it's not always quite as energy efficient or economically as efficient as what you might think it is. Now, if you're just going to be sitting at home watching it burn anyway, that might be a different story, but most people set their furnace and forget it. The unvented heaters I consider to be a significant no-no. I do not like them at all. Matter of fact, most of them, in order to even get approved, are listed as decorative units. Usually you'll find a plate on there that says to open a window or door while they're burning, not to burn them for more than X number of hours in a day. Never, ever, ever put one in a sleeping room and don't sleep in the rooms where they're at, because while they are burning cleanly, and I just mentioned that the darker the flame, what they end up doing is putting a catalyst or something that will actually hold heat to burn it cleaner. But you're still getting a lot of moisture into the house, but what I'll call indoor air pollutants. So I'm not fond of the unvented units at all. The airtight units, they do produce a little bit more heat. My guess is what happened was when somebody put your gas log into your masonry fireplace, they didn't take into account the fact that the gas burns a little bit warmer, so therefore the flue size can be smaller and still get the same amount of draw. The hotter gases don't require as large a flue going out. So what ends up happening is you have this nice hot fire and this great big huge flue, and you're actually drawing air from the house up out the chimney because you've got so much air moving through there. Usually a gas fireplace has a smaller diameter flue pipe. Of course, if it was originally designed to burn wood, it has to have a larger flue going up through it to ensure a proper draw. Kind of a catch-22. Unless you burn a fireplace on a regular basis, I'm talking more than 10 or 12 hours a day, the chances of it actually being energy efficient are pretty slim. By the time, particularly for wood, where you have to let the embers die out and cool down. You have to leave the flue open. Even with a set of glass doors over the top of it or over the front of it, you're still getting a fairly healthy air draw up through the chimney. Particularly the colder the weather, the more air draw we have going up that chimney. So it's hard to get any energy efficiency out of a fireplace. You can get some space heating with the air type units or a single room. Generally speaking, people today are not comfortable unless the entire room is warm. So heating one room at a time is, I don't want to call it our alternative lifestyle, but it's definitely not the normal. So it's not something that I've got the most experience in. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to refer to the web here. You're going to have to do some searching there, and that's going to be very opinionated both ways. So you'll have to kind of make heads or tails out of what you can come up with.
All right, I hope that helps. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Just, again, to go back to the issue of an unvented, some kind of gas fireplace or gas insert, is there some possibility that you could have carbon monoxide issues with that as well?
Anytime you burn a flame, you're going to be getting some byproducts, and carbon monoxide is one of them. Now, the hotter the flame burns, the less carbon monoxide that's going to be produced. I don't have any stats saying exactly what quantity at what temperature or whatever. But yes, there is a chance of getting that in or getting some materials, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, carbon sulfides. We even have a little bit of sulfur in the gas we burn around here. So there's a lot of things that are put back into the house. And even with the catalyst or with the ceramic inserts, which work much like your catalytic converter on your car, where they just get super hot and are supposed to burn away all the impurities, you're still getting some type of combustion gases back inside the house, obviously, because it's not venting to the outside. Particularly don't like the kerosene or the oil type burners. Mm-hmm. Whereas I know at a lot of times, particularly in power outages, we have problems where people go and pick up a little kerosene heater or a little propane heater for temporary use. Well, that works fine. But again, read the instructions. It says to open a window for ventilation. So while it's doing a space heating, it's not heating the room, and you're supposed to have enough ventilation to keep enough oxygen in.
Yeah.
Anytime an unvented heater has an oxygen sensor on it so that if it starts depleting too much of the oxygen in the room that it shuts itself off, I've got to think that it's competing for the same air I'm trying to breathe, and I'm really not sure I want that competition going on.
Yeah. Well, those kind of heaters you're talking about were really not designed to be inside people's houses.
Well, they're more designed for temporary use, decorative use, sunrooms, areas that are not built tightly. The tighter we build a house, the more we have to worry about what we're putting into it. The less air that we move through the house, the longer things stay in it. There's all sorts of things. By making the houses tighter and more energy efficient, we have to be very, very careful about what we're bringing back in. And an unvented or non-vented style fireplace, unvented style heater, propane heaters, things like that, all add tremendous amounts of indoor air pollution into the house that's not leaving on the newer houses.
All right. Let's talk next with somebody in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a quick question about I'm getting moisture on our windows in our bedrooms on the inside. I wasn't sure. They're new windows. They've been installed just a few months ago. And I'm wondering if I should be concerned and then what we should do about it.
All right. Well, we'll go back to moisture real quick. 101 on moisture. Once water evaporates, it becomes a water vapor. Water vapor moves according to vapor pressure, not airflow. Vapor pressure will try and equalize throughout an entire house. Once that vapor pressure equalizes, and the vapor will move opposite of airflow, it will move through windows, walls, doors, floors, etc. It does not move through a vapor barrier, which is why I always require a vapor barrier in a crawl space, so we don't get the moisture from the soil up in the house. If you've got water on the windows, it's not necessarily because we've got a leak at the window or anything like that. The window is going to be one of the coldest places in the house. So yeah. Therefore, that is going to be the first place that our water vapor is going to start collecting. So if you've got water on the window, it tells me, A, that we've got too much humidity in the house. Now, the moisture source could be a number of different things, a crawl space with no vapor barrier, a dryer that's not vented to the outside, not using the fan for the shower, boiling lobsters for a party of 30. Any number of different things can be putting that moisture in the house. It's not uncommon when we have a quick temperature change where we go from one day and it's 50 or 60 degrees and raining and the next day is 22 degrees. There's enough humidity in the air that we can get some moisture on those windows. If it happens once or twice, it's usually an indication the house is starting to dry out. If it happens more than once or twice, you have a humidity source in the house that we have to locate.
Okay, so, I mean, we were running a humidifier, but we should just turn that off because we obviously have too much humidity in the house?
That is correct. If you are running a humidifier and you have moisture on the windows, you have exceeded the amount of moisture you want to put in the house.
Okay, so just turn it off till the moisture's gone.
Yeah. Actually, the studies that I've seen on humidifiers show that while at one point, if the room has a high humidity, when you first walk into it, it feels more comfortable. But after you've been in the room for longer periods of time, it becomes less and less comfortable. So actually a drier house is better. Now, obviously, if a house gets too dry, it gets uncomfortable as well. But most of the new construction, particularly now that you've got a new set of windows in the house, you've tightened the house up, it takes a lot less moisture in the house to make the house relatively high in humidity.
Okay.
You're adjusting humidity levels relative to outdoor temperature. And as your outdoor temperature drops, there is less moisture out there, so it doesn't take much moisture in the house to be relatively high. To set a power humidifier correctly, you need to adjust it every time the outdoor temperature changes. The rating that you would set it at, say, 30 degrees is much higher than what you would set it at, say, 5 or 10 degrees. So unless you're moving that humidistat around to compensate for outdoor temperature, yes, you can overhumidify it. And that sounds like what's happened here.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, very good. We'll go on here. Next talk with somebody in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. It's me again. I called earlier and had the long discussion about what might be with the allergies and the burning. And there were two things I did forget to ask about, and I did hear the other woman who called about the gas leak. I don't smell any gas anywhere. I did think of that, but I appreciate her calling, and I do have a carbon monoxide or whatever detector thing. So what do you recommend for furnace maintenance, to have it looked at and cleaned or whatever it is one does to furnaces to maintain them? How frequently do you recommend that?
It kind of depends on the age of the furnace and the style of the furnace. Generally about every 2 years or so, I would recommend getting somebody come out and take a look at it.
Okay.
On the older furnaces, it's not a bad idea to do it once a year.
Okay.
But on the newer units that are a little more sealed, a little bit less maintenance oriented, you don't need to have somebody come out every year.
So I've lived here almost 10 years and the landlord hasn't done it once. So I would not be out of line to firmly request that he have it serviced at this point.
Okay, that's putting me between a rock and a hard spot. I can't tell him how to maintain his stuff, but I do recommend the furnace be more serviced more often than once every 10 years.
I didn't mean that. I just meant as a professional, would you say?
I would recommend getting them cleaned, get them not necessarily completely cleaned, but at least checked and gone through about every 2 years.
Okay. Comment on that then without using your name. But the other is that there is odor that comes from the duct, and I've noticed that for several years even. And if there's no forced air, I smell it, you know, sometimes it just wafts into the house through the duct. When the forced air is on, it is obviously then propelled into the house. And it's, you know, it's a stale, it smells almost garbagey kind of, I mean, it's not pleasant. And so I don't know what that, you know, what that might be and if that might have anything to do with the allergy issues. Is there any thoughts about why that might be in the ducts or coming from the ducts, an odor like any odor?
I think you're chasing the wrong thing here. I really doubt very much that it is coming from the furnace. I mean, you may notice it near furnace ducts. When the furnace fan is not running, there is little or no air movement through the furnace. It's got two openings. It's got the return air and it's got the supply. Well, usually, depending on how it's installed, the return air is up high and the supplies are down low. So we can get just a little bit of warm air going up, but the cold air falling down is going to basically make a static or a non-moving situation. So unless the fan is going – now, obviously, without seeing it, I can't see if maybe there's a return air duct someplace that it shouldn't be, if they've got some ductwork disconnected in the basement, or maybe we've got some an open piece out in the attic. And there's any number of different things. Yes, you can have the furnace checked, but generally speaking, things don't crawl into the furnace ducts to live in.
So. Okay. I mean, and I didn't necessarily even know. I can only just say what it is that I smell and where I smell it. And,
right. And yeah. Again, the only thing I can see for something like that when you've got a severe allergy type deal is to do the air quality test.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate your comments again.
All right. Thank you. We're coming down now. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with Spies Home Inspection Service. And he's here on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday to talk about home maintenance. We'll try to get in as many callers as we can. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Champaign on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm calling about a problem with a damp basement, and Scott Spies, you have checked and advised us. You came down and did a very thorough job, and we plan to implement everything you said about putting soil on the outside and fixing the duct and so on. But in the meantime, as we make our plans and look at our finances to do this, I noticed that there was mildew on the shelves in the basement, and we've never had mildew down there. And I just wondered, is this something that will go away when we finally totally implement your suggestions, or whether I should call in some company to come and clean out the mildew? It's going to be a huge problem because it's on shelves in between the pots and pans and so on. So what do you advise that we do for that?
This year has been a really wet year. We've had a lot of basements that have gotten wet for the first time. Sounds like what you've got is just some excess humidity. It hasn't been vented out. During the summer, if you're running the air conditioner, that takes most of the humidity out. But it's not a bad idea to run a dehumidifier. As far as mildew, once things have started to grow and get a foothold, they don't usually just disappear. You can have the mildew or mold go dormant by drying it out to where it doesn't expand anymore. Mm-hmm. But until it's wiped out or cleaned or covered with paint or something like that, it doesn't just go away.
Okay, so are there companies that actually do this, or is it something that's...
Yeah, there are several professional cleaning companies that could do that for you.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. And next we'll talk with someone in Bloomington, Illinois, line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, I had a question regarding blowing in some insulation. I've got a single-story ranch house, 35 years old, and there's only like one layer of insulation, the rollout type. I wanted to blow some insulation in up there, but it has soffits that are about five, six feet that go away from the house, and someone told me I shouldn't blow that in there unless I put soffit vents in. I mean, I have roof vents. What do you think about that?
Well, you don't want to blow the insulation out over the soffits. Usually they can make some cardboard forms where you can actually put them, depending on how much room you've got. Usually when I see over the top of a porch where it goes out 6 or 8 feet, they put a cardboard dam up, and they can build the insulation up that way without having it fall into the soffit area. If it's a standard overhang, they make air chutes, things that are designed to allow the airflow from the soffit area to come up into the attic, but still allow you to put the insulation fairly deep out at the outside edges of the wall. You don't want to block your soffits. In other words, you don't want to blow so much insulation in that we don't have any air movement in from the soffits. Soffits themselves usually have some type of ventilation. Most of the time they're not an airtight type situation. Even if they don't have direct grills in them, usually the soffit areas will have a lot of air infiltration just because they're not a sealed area. So you don't want to block that soffit area from the attic. So taking that insulation and blocking it from the roof sheathing down to the roof itself or to the ceiling itself, you don't want to block all that. You want to make sure that you do have some air movement out to that soffit area.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, very good. And let's go next to Urbana, line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. I have about a 35, 40-year-old house. The windows are in good shape. the storm windows are only double track and they're kind of leaky and stuff. I read in an article in one of these building magazines about the cost effectiveness of replacing windows with the new insulated glass, et cetera, versus storm windows, and it's a marginal savings.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any opinion on that, or do you have any?
Well, I don't. I haven't done any exact studies on it, but in my personal opinion, I feel that they are correct. Replacement windows serve a purpose when you don't have any weather stripping around the around the windows themselves, or where the windows are coming apart. But generally speaking, a good single glazed window with a good quality storm window is very effective. What a double glazed panel does is it gives you two panes of glass with an inert gas in between them. That air gap, or that space between them, is actually your insulating area. Air is our best insulator. If air is stagnant and does not move, it does not have any convection, it does not transfer heat well at all. So it becomes a very good insulator. Insulation, fiberglass, is merely there to help reduce airflow. It's just to trap air. So if you've got a prime window and it's sealed well, you've got good weather stripping on it, it's relatively tight, the putty's good, so the glass is tight in the frames, etc., and you have a storm window on the outside, you have that air barrier between the storm window and the prime window where there's very little air movement. Now, you don't necessarily need to seal or caulk your storm window. Matter of fact, it should never be caulked at the bottom. That storm window doesn't need to be airtight. It just needs to restrict any air movement so we don't have air blowing past the prime window. So as long as the storm windows are closed and we don't have a broken panel, it's not open top and bottom, something just to prevent air current or air movement past the prime window, the storm windows a good quality storm window with a good quality prime window has a very close energy efficiency to a lot of the newer replacement windows.
Well, I was thinking whether I should replace my furnace, which is just as old as the house, and that would help as well. So it's like $450 per window versus $50 per window for the stuff. So
right. I would say that I would say that probably putting a good storm window on will help quite a bit. Of course, furnace efficiency, if you've got an older, say a 55 or 60% efficient furnace, or whether you've got an 80% efficient furnace and where you replace it with a 90 or 95, It all depends on how much savings you got. But you definitely want to do your sealing, your improvements prior to putting the new furnace in, because the new furnace will then be sized to the heat loss that you've got of the house. So you don't necessarily need the furnace oversized if you're going to add a whole bunch more energy efficiency to the home itself.
Well, the cost difference between 90% and 85% is huge. So
yeah.
Think about that. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling.
We see we get one more caller here. We have somebody on a cell phone in Chicago, I think, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I've noticed streaks coming down my shingles. I had a shingle company come out and give me a quote. They said really I didn't need new shingles. He said he would try and call back with someone who could clean that. I didn't receive the call back, so I'm wondering who in Champaign-Urbana might do that.
I'm going to assume this is a light-colored or white-type shingle.
It's a brown shingle.
Okay. Usually streaks down a shingle are not any real issue as far as the structural integrity of the shingle. Very rarely does it affect the shingles. It's more of a cosmetic issue. Could be the mineral granules they put down there may have had a high iron ore content. We could be getting a little bit of rust on it. It could be that we've gotten something on there that we get some type of call it almost an algae or a small plant growth. There are some algicides or some coatings that can be sprayed onto it. There are companies here in town that do that. There is also what they call a shingle saver, which is a zinc or a copper strip that they put across the top that they let the acidity from our rain naturally wash down some of the zinc or copper down through there, and that'll help as well. If you wanted to call over to our office, I believe my father, Hank, is over there with the names of a couple of companies that could apply something like that for you.
All right. We're going to have to leave it at that. We just are here at the end of the time. Scott Spies works with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday to take these kind of questions, and we'll see you again next month. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, David.
Also, we want you to know this program is made possible in part by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors. We'd like to thank them for their support of Focus 580. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. We will take a break, as we usually do, and we'll have more Focus in the next hour. Dr. Suzanne Troopin will be here. We'll talk about women's health. First, though, we have an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Wheat is showing a lot of red on the screen, while corn and soybeans are both in the green. Let's look at the particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat at 576, down 17 and a quarter. March 590 and a half, down 17. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 543, down 11 and a quarter. March 562 and a half, down 12. May 577, down 12. July 590, down 13. December corn, 385 and a half, now a quarter, up 5. March 402 and a quarter, up 5 and a half. Now 5 1/4, May 414, up 5 1/2, July 425, up 5 1/4, December 2009, 449, up 6. January soybeans, 913 1/2, up 17 1/2, March 923, up 18, May 933 1/4, up 17 1/2. Let's go out to November of 2009, 937 1/4, up 17 1/4. December soybeans.